What's the source of wisdom? How can you live a more conscious life? Sometimes it's the questions that bring you your own quantum leaps. Wisdom Talk Radio brings you conversations with visionary thinkers, business mentors, and provocative authors and teachers, along with resources that point the way for you to claim your potential in service to the world. Join Laurie Seymour at Wisdom Talk Radio for explorations in conscious living. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcast or find us at Wisdom Talk Radio on Facebook.
Just a quick disclaimer, during this episode, I was traveling and didn't have access to my normal audio quality. Thank you for your understanding and please enjoy this incredible episode with Devin Pipers. Today we are joined by Devin Pipers, a meditation expert. Meditation is her passion and purpose. A meditator since 2002, the practice has been deeply transformative for her. After devoting 4 years to the study and practice of meditation under the guidance of a master teacher in the Indian Himalayas, Devin's sessions incorporate multiple traditions and techniques, including mindfulness, breathwork, mantra, gratitude practice, and loving kindness. She is masterful at translating all she's learned into simple terms, making her classes appropriate for first-time meditators as well as experts. No matter what your practice and experience level, her approach effectively reduces stress and promotes well-being. She's a teacher and blogger for withinmeditation.com and also works with companies via wellness workshops, meditation sessions, and mindful communication coaching. Welcome to the Sensitivity Doctors Podcast. Here we explore everything from overcoming anxiety to living in a world not always designed for our sensitive wiring. Whether it's navigating business, parenthood, overcoming trauma, or getting what you want out of your relationships, we invite you to this empowering journey of self-compassion and growth. Sit back, relax, and here are your hosts.
Devin, we are so excited to have you here today. Meditation is something that both Dr. Jean and I are really passionate about. So I can't wait to learn more from someone who has really dedicated so much of their life to this. So Devin, can you start by sharing with our listeners maybe first what drew you to meditation and also what are some of the benefits that you think are really important for people to be aware of?
Such a great question. What drew me to meditation? I tried it once when I was 19 and it freaked me out. I was just the concept of sitting still and closing my eyes and just being with my mind and my inner voice was terrifying. So I didn't try again until I was 22. That was 2002 when I really started meditating, and it was because of yoga. I had a physical yoga practice, and every time I would lie down in Shavasana and the corpse pose at the end, I would go into this state that was not sleep and not dream and not fully being awake. And I was really curious about that state. So I had a teacher when I was in grad school who offered to teach us how to meditate. And that was a mantra-based meditation. And when I started studying meditation and the philosophy behind it, I just got really, really excited about it. I recognized that state in meditation that I'm kind of pointing to or referring to is very soothing. It's very comforting. It's very decompressing. It's a real true conscious rest. I think it's really beneficial for us in our modern day living to consciously shift ourselves out of a state of stress, of fight or flight, back into our parasympathetic nervous system, the rest and digest nervous system. And the science behind meditation really supports those effects. And those effects are long reaching. They're mental, they're physical, they're emotional. So no matter who you are, meditation can help for sure.
I love that you disclosed about the kind of the trepidation around it. Well, how am I going to sit here and not move and not do anything and just to calm the mind? So I know so many people probably relate to that.
Yeah, it's huge, even with my students. And, you know, there's this common misconception that somehow you should be able to stop your mind. And I like to say That's not possible. That's an unrealistic expectation. It's not that your mind may not, after maybe some time or some breath work, may calm down to a place of rest, but your mind, I consider it a sense. It's like your sixth sense, you know, and while you're sitting in meditation, your other senses still function. And so if I get upset with my ears still hearing, why would I get upset with my mind still producing thought? I mean, that's its job. But my control in meditation, my choice is whether or not to engage with those thoughts, whether to actively think them and follow them down the rabbit hole, or whether to acknowledge, okay, there's a thought. I'm just going to let it go, either by bringing my attention back to my breath or my body, or maybe I visualize the release of that thought. Maybe I see it in a helium balloon and that thought is floating away into the sky space of my awareness. So just recognizing that you have the power to choose when you're thinking and when you're not, right, is really pretty profound.
That's really powerful, because there's so many things about life that cannot be controlled. And to have that ability to make those conscious decisions. I've talked with clients before saying, well, we can't get angry at our brain for doing what it's meant to do. But I love the positive visual you gave with, you can't be angry at your ears for hearing. That is so beautiful. And I will quote you when I use that with my clients in the future.
and also the same way we, you know, I hear a sound, there's a dog barking outside. I don't personalize that. I don't say, well, that's my sound and I have to deal with that or address that and figure out who does that dog belong to, and you know, why is it barking? You know, we don't personalize our other senses the same extent that we personalize our thinking. But you know, you don't really own a thought until you decide that it's mine. So a thought is just, it's just a wave of consciousness that spontaneously arises. You didn't ask to think that thought. It just popped into your head, right? So not claiming it, not owning it, not taking responsibility for every single thought, and just recognizing this doesn't define me. This isn't who I am. It's just a sense. Yeah.
I love everything that you're saying. How you're explaining it is so profound to me. But just from, for example, my perspective, when I was starting, and sometimes when I'm more anxious than other times, like what you're saying now sounds, of course, that's what I should do. But then I sit down to do it. It's like, this is the hardest thing ever. So what can you maybe just break it down for us from what you've explained to us now to the person sitting down for the first time trying to do this? What is that going to look like?
Absolutely. The thing is, this is not what our minds want to do. The meditation in its simplest form, I would define it by the definition of mindfulness. Mindful meditation is simply paying attention to this present moment without any judgment. That's it. That's all. It's really that simple. Yet our minds, my mind, your mind, anybody's mind, doesn't want to do that. It wants to dig up the past. It wants to project the future. And that's your job. That's the mind's job, is a survival sense, right? It's always scanning for how could this be better and what can go wrong? So recognizing first that the nature of the human mind, and without personalizing it, is restlessness. It's doubtful. It's anxious, because it's doing its job to protect you and make you successful and safe. So first of all, depersonalize that. And then recognize, I am also not my mind. In meditation, we start to recognize that I'm the observer of my mind. So there's a little bit of space between me and my thoughts. That's why I can let them go, visualize releasing them, or choose something different than thinking, right? So what we have to do is give our mind something positive to focus on at first when we start. Right? Something to anchor your mind in this moment that prevents it from wandering and digging up the past or pushing into the future with a sense of worry. So the techniques in meditation and different forms of meditation are not for you. You're always here. You're always present. There's nowhere else you could exist but right here, right now. But your mind might be living in the past. Mm-hmm. Your mind might be living in the future. So we just bring the mind back through these anchors. So if I have a first-time meditator in my classes, we start with some breath work. Why? The science behind meditation. Let's just decompress and de-escalate your nervous system. You have an overstimulated nervous system. Mm-hmm. Guess what's part of that nervous system? Your mind. The more stimulated you are in your body, the more you're going to be thinking. So let's just calm you down as a whole system first. And then maybe, you know, we're watching the breath moving in our bodies. Maybe we add a little bit of mantra or a count to that breath work to give the mind something to chew on. I often think of the mind as like an untrained puppy. And this is great because it gives us compassion for our minds, right? It's not your enemy. It's this sweet, like obedient, loyal, really energetic creature that wants to run and dig and sniff and wants to pull you over here. And it's like, I'm just training that puppy, just gently guiding it back to my side in this moment again and again and again. And I'm giving that puppy something to chew on, whether it's a mantra or some breath work or a visualization. I'm giving the puppy a treat so that it can relax here in the moment with me. Yeah.
My daughter has a book called Puppy Mind. And it explains that your mind is like a puppy, and it explains meditation for 4 to 6 year olds and how your mind does all these cool things exactly like a puppy. And the book's name is actually Puppy Mind. So I was thinking about that when you said that. Yeah.
In India, the way that they describe it, when I was living in India, it's always called the monkey mind. And monkeys are very common there. But for Westerners, I find they relate more to the puppy mind. Yeah.
I love that because I have heard monkey mind. And when I think of monkeys, although they are highly intelligent and cute and amazing animals, we're not always quite so close to them. Whereas puppies, I mean, they live with us, we cuddle with them. We're so connected to them that I can see.
Yeah. And puppies, we love them. And sometimes they're naughty, right? Sometimes they'll take a poop where they're not supposed to, or they'll chew your shoe. And it's like your mind will do the same thing. You know, it'll deposit a thought that's really negative about you. That's a little poop, right? Just, you know, you got to sweep that up, but that's not you. That's not your truth.
So I was curious about, you know, you mentioned restlessness. There's this other kind of subset of restlessness that oftentimes when I work with clients or even in just some of the research I've explored, I get a little bit more cautious. And it's the restlessness around, you know, panic or trauma, or even there's some studies around when someone's in active suicidal ideation. I don't know if you can speak to this, but I'm curious if there are certain forms of meditation that are safer in those instances and maybe forms that you would want to be cautious
of. That's a great question. So meditation can be triggering for some conditions, including but not limited to PTSD, also psychosis. It can be triggering. It's not necessarily safe or advised for everyone. And yet there is trauma-informed meditation. So if I had a trauma physically, perhaps focusing on my body is going to make me feel more anxious. Maybe I need to focus on the sounds in the room around me, you know, that are comforting to me, familiar to me. Maybe the only part of my body that feels safe is the pressure through the bottoms of my feet when I'm seated for meditation. So I keep bringing my mind whenever I feel some anxiety arising, I keep feeling, no, you're here, you're safe, you're sound. And also using affirmations and mantras can be very helpful. Like, I am safe, right? Having the mind repeat that over and over and over again. When you're repeating a phrase, whether it's traditionally in Sanskrit or in English, your mind doesn't have space to bring in scary thoughts. And you're again having the mind chew on something that is beneficial for you rather than scary. And having said that, I think it's very important for us as practitioners to be mindful that there is no one way that suits everyone. And I, as a teacher, am incredibly aware of that. So I like to teach everything. I'm like, here's it. And you don't just have a hammer, because if you only have a hammer, then all you can do is hit that nail, right? Maybe you'll need a screwdriver one day. Maybe you'll need a wrench. So I give a lot of different teachings of different forms of meditation to be able to empower people to meet themselves where they're at on that day. Suicidal ideation, I've done some research into the science behind gratitude and behind compassion. And if you look into that science.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, if you look into the science of gratitude particularly, they've had some incredible jaw-dropping results with inpatients in the hospital with suicidal ideation. 98% of these patients that they actively taught gratitude practices to felt an increase in their optimism and their sense of hope. And that to me is staggering. 98% wow. of just a small sample, but it was all of the inpatients. So it was, you know, they were quite serious and sick and needed that attention. So I always like to say, you know, we're not spiritually bypassing here. We're not trying to positive think our way out of something and repress or ignore it. But you can feel your feelings and still focus on what you want to think about. You can feel sad and still find gratitude. You can feel despair and still find gratitude. And sometimes, because we're complex beings, sometimes that little bit of levity, that little bit of brightness from the exploration of the gratitude can really help. So that would be my response for that question.
That is an immensely helpful response.
It means so much to me what you're saying, because our listeners know I have panic disorder. When I have panic attacks, some of the things that are difficult for me to come back from is feeling like I failed. And it has helped me immensely in those moments to be grateful for and celebrate. Thank you that I'm still trying. Thank you that I'm still trying. You know, I don't have to say thank you that I didn't have a panic attack, or thank you that I'm like 100% healthy, but it's that little bit. It really does help just kind of take you a little bit further away from that edge. So I love that you kind of confirm.
Well, thank you for your vulnerable share. And then, you know, I really love transparency, because especially as women, I feel like when we are transparent and vulnerable and brave, we're actually empowering and inspiring other people to speak their truth as well. Mm-hmm. I have suffered from anxiety my whole life. I had a panic attack. Mm-hmm. My first panic attack was when I was 8 years old, and they thought it was asthma, because they thought there's no way this small child could be having a panic disorder, right? So they gave me an inhaler and it did nothing. It was all my mind and my emotions. I was a sensitive little creature. So, you know, that hypersensitivity, which actually reminds me, if you've never heard of the work of Dr. Elaine Aron, A-R-O-N. Yeah.
I love her.
I discovered.
She is kind of the godmother of our podcast, honestly.
Yeah. So when I discovered I was a highly sensitive person, it made me accept myself on a deeper level. And I now teach, 12-week courses on how to manage your anxiety, like one employable skill each week. And I speak from a place of knowledge. It's here's the thing. You don't have anxiety. You're aware of anxiety, but your awareness is never anxious. So in meditation, what we're really doing is we're shifting our attention from our identification with the body, with the senses, with the emotions, with the changing thoughts. And we're shifting that identification in meditation to the unchanging awareness and existence. So your awareness, it can be aware of hunger, but your awareness isn't hungry, right? Your awareness, you can be aware of cold, but your awareness isn't cold. When we start to identify with the awareness that's always fully present, then there's a bit of relief. There's a bit of spaciousness. So I don't say I'm anxious. I say I'm aware of anxiety. And I don't even like that word anxiety. You know what I call it? Excess energy. I'm aware of excess energy.
Love that.
Yeah, because anxiety has a stigma. That. You know, when we say I'm an anxious person or I have anxiety, We feel like failures. We feel like there's something wrong with us. We feel like we're weak somehow compared to other people. We're not. We're more sensitive, which is a superpower. We have this superpower, but we do get that excess energy. So then I just ask myself, in this moment, when I feel that excess energy, okay, my job is to manage the sensations. How can I de-escalate this excess energy? Do I need to move my body? Do I need to breathe deeper? Do I need to connect with my pets? Do I need to call a friend? Like, how am I going to de-escalate this excess energy? And that's really helpful for me. So thanks for sharing.
Oh, that's beautiful.
I absolutely love that too, because it reminds me a lot of a therapy that I tend to talk about a lot, I think, because it has to do with awareness without over-identifying, but is that acceptance and commitment therapy where you see something, you can not immerse yourself or enmesh yourself, but it's almost like seeing an experience up on a movie screen and viewing what's happening and offering that conscious awareness, as I think you're so eloquently describing. And I love the way that you are empowering through the way that you're teaching meditation. There's a form of meditation that I'm going to throw this to Jean that she was curious about. Well, because of all the meditation that I'm aware of and that I do practice, this is one that I really don't understand myself. So
we love to talk about transcendental meditation, because what is that? How does that help? Because my view of that is all of these celebrities that you're seeing talking about, it's like, oh, I do transcendental meditation. And it sounds so chic and, you know, like Chanel-ish. But like, what is it?
You know what? It's so simple. And the thing about TM is you pay to play in TM, right? Like you buy a secret mantra that's in Sanskrit, and you're told never to tell anyone else, otherwise it'll lose its power. I give those ancient mantras away for free.
You actually pay money?
You pay to join Transcendental Meditation, the movement, for sure. And then you have this secret mantra. But I studied in India. I know the mantras. I've read the yogic scriptures. I give these mantras away for free. The mantras that people are using for thousands of years. Everyone deserves access to those mantras. And here's the thing, mantra meditation, mantra roughly translated, it means mind release. It's the repetition of a phrase in time with your natural breath that unravels the knots of your mind. So when we're doing TM, we're just repeating a mantra, it'll be in Sanskrit, over and over and over and over again with the mind. Now, eventually, when the mind gets relaxed and released, because it's like putting the mind on a little hamster wheel where it can tire itself out, maybe the mantra starts to fade away. And you have that state of mind that, you know, the golden state where there's no thoughts and you're just resting in the awareness, that samadhi, that evenness. And that's beautiful. But you don't need to sign up or pay for these tools. They're out there. There are teachers who will give them to you for free. and you know, you can, if you don't have to be bound even to the Sanskrit, if for some reason, you know, this language is triggering for any reason, I have had that before, you can use an English mantra and it'll still be effectively transcendental meditation. Because what they're talking about with transcendence, it's the release of the mind where there's no more thinking. And you're just resting in awareness as awareness. So that's what mantra does. Yeah.
But then would there be people who would say, yeah, you pay for this mantra because it's specific to you, I guess, like the code that you need. So anybody can use any mantra. It's not like I'm going to get a worse mantra because I didn't pay the fee.
No, certainly not. I mean, all of this knowledge, you know, TM only became popular in the 70s when the Beatles got into it. So it's like that knowledge is ancient knowledge. It's all there. If you care to go back and read the ancient scriptures, which I did, like it's all there. It's all available to you. But, I just feel like this tool is our birthright. We deserve to know our place of peace within ourselves. Yes, I get paid to teach classes, but honestly, I was doing it for free before I became a professional because I love this so much. And I love helping people and empowering mm-hmm. people and letting them find the tools that brings them back to their most peaceful present selves. Because, you know, my motivation when I moved to India was just not being able to bear the world or myself as I thought I was. So if people are in desperation or having a crisis moment, I have endless compassion for that. You know, I'll give you everything I've got. Yeah. So TM, it's just a mantra.
And with mantra work, I'm thinking of, you know, different aspects. I always have kind of this creative brain and then my science brain. And I look at the science of it and I'm curious, two questions. First, is it all internal mantra or is it verbal mantra?
Great question. It can be either. When we are, usually mantra meditation is silent when you take it to sound or chanting and you're using a mala perhaps. Do I have one here? Mm-hmm. No. Okay. So it looks like a rosary. It's just a bead, 108 beads. And meditators that to count as if to keep time. So one repetition of the mantra is one bead, and then I'll feed the bead through and next repetition is one bead. So it kept time prior to clocks. You know how many, if you do 10 malas of mantra, you know how long it'll take you. But also you can chant, and that's called japa, the practice of the mala plus the chanting. And the same thing, you know, you can do this alone, you can do this in a group. It's really beautiful. Where you just, you know, you're sitting around and you have your eyes closed and you're counting with your beads, but you're also sort of chanting this mantra. It has the same effect. It's very transcendent. It's very, very beautiful. And I also like it because a lot of Westerners are afraid of their own voice. You know, we have this sort of sense of smallness. Like I'm a Pilates instructor as well. And I'm always like, ladies, like, don't be shy to breathe loudly. Like if you can't even bear the sound of your breath being loud, how are you going to speak your truth when you really need to? You know, we need to start taking up more space, you know, releasing our voices through ways that are helpful and safe. So I love chanting. Mm. Yeah, you can do it either way. What's your second question?
Mm-hmm. Well, and just to piggyback off of that, I love if you think of the verbal chanting or the audible chanting, you're massaging and regulating your vagus nerve and your whole nervous system.
That's the science. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Like this is what I love, Dr. Kelly, is like the reasons that the masters did things a certain way are now, only now, thousands of years later, being scientifically verified. Like when I realized that touching your hands together, bringing your hands to your heart in some way, anyway, that it releases oxytocin in your brain. I was like, oh my gosh, it's not just because it looks cool. You know, like there's a reason for the breath work. There's a reason for the you know, that's vagal toning. There's a reason for the hands to the chest. And science is just starting to tune in to this yogic science where they didn't have these verified, you know, scientific basis for it. It was, I would say, spontaneous, intuitive wisdom that they had as masters of meditation that now we're just starting to understand why. And that's so exciting. Yeah.
I know. I love that. That's so neat. And it makes so much sense because I'm going to get even nerdier on all of our listeners. If you look up the homunculus man, have you guys ever heard of the homunculus man?
No.
So you're going to want to Google it. It's a wild image that's created showing how our skin, which Jean, you'll love that because you're a skin gal, how our skin is connected to our cortical brain and our mouth and our hands are the biggest on the homunculus man because they are the most regulating. And so if you think about the hands being one of the most regulating portions of our body. Two, when you're chanting, if you're using your mouth, you're also using your mouth, which is highly regulating.
Yeah.
And the hands, that's wild to me though, that you can increase oxytocin all on your own, because I think I've always had this impression that it needs to be, you know, you're hugging someone else.
No, Dependent on another, and neither is your happiness. You know, like it's not true. External. Like that's the problem with some of our societal norms is, you know, the senses flow outwards. So we're always seeking for that fulfillment externally. We don't feel like we're enough unless it's reflected back to us through another or through a group or through, you know, an affirmation, an amount of success. But that's what I love about meditation is it starts to show you that everything you seek, you're seeking, you already are. And that the reason you're seeking love is because your nature is love. Come home to yourself. You know, it's like you have this diamond in your inner pocket, but you've never checked and you're looking all over begging, but you're absolutely wealthy, you know? And it's like, it's always there. It's always within you, that comfort, that acceptance, that peacefulness, that contentment and fulfillment. It will bubble up surface of your experience if you're patient enough to look.
Gosh, I love that. And the second part of my two-part question was actually taking, and I don't even know why I said it was two parts, guys. It's a completely different question. But I think because it was connected to mantra work.
Oh, yeah.
So with mantras, I think about so highly sensitive people who are a lot of our listeners have a very difficult time, at least I can relate to this, with the pain of the world and compassion fatigue.
Yes.
And feeling like there's not things that we can do to touch every trauma that's happening around us.
Yes.
And I have found the use of metta meditation.
Yes. I was just thinking metta.
Like, yeah. So I would love if you wouldn't mind unpacking how this kind of, it's not TM, but it's a mantra form of meditation. Maybe it is TM. I don't know.
It's not.
How is that powerful for highly sensitives?
Oh gosh, it's so good for us. Metta, in it's a Pali word, but Buddha, the language of Buddha's time, it translates to loving kindness. So this practice has been used for like 3,000 years by master teachers to enhance and increase our capacity for compassion. Now, the good news is you're born with it. They've already done studies, even on infants, with pupillary response, measuring distress through the pupils or a release of distress through the pupillary response, that we all have concern for others. And we're hardwired because it's evolutionary, right? It's like we will survive better if we take care of each other. But, you know, we also, the number one trait that people look for in a partner is kindness. So it's kind of, it's all inclusive. So especially for highly sensitive people, when we feel powerless, when we feel overwhelmed, when we are, you know, scrolling through news media or social media, and we feel ourselves taking on the energies of what we're seeing and hearing and feeling, it's good to recognize there's a difference between being informed and triggered. There's a fine line there. Mm. And when you start getting triggered, take your power back. You can't change the external situation. God, I wish I could end the two wars that are raging right now. It's not in my capacity. Mm. What do I have power over? My internal experience. Mm. What I am choosing to focus on is powerful. So metta is a visualization-based practice where we are visualizing in a sequence of images in our mind's eye, different people or groups of people, including ourselves, including someone we love really easily and deeply, including someone who's hard to love, including all beings on this earth. And we're sending them blessings or well wishes. So in our minds, we're seeing the image, we're connecting emotionally with our hearts. It's really an emotion-based practice, which is great for empaths and highly sensitive people because that's their superpower. And you're turning the light on within your heart and you're really connecting. And from that genuine connection, you're sending out silently in your head, maybe something like, may they be happy, may they feel whole, may they know peace. So this is what we know now through science, through research, is that in the giving, we also receive. That's the science behind compassion. It can literally lengthen your lifespan because the same genes that are impacted by social connection and compassion are the same genes that dictate inflammation and immune response. So the more socially connected you are, the more compassionate you are, the healthier you're going to be, the longer you're going to live. It's verified. It's validated. You can check it out. So this practice is actually powerful. And a lot of times, you know, people might have trouble if they're skeptics or they're really intellectual with something like metta. And I get it. For a while, when I was younger, I had a resistance to it as well. I think because it was so vulnerable, maybe I didn't want to go there. But also I was a skeptic and I was like, how is just imagining and feeling feelings in my body doing anything for anybody else? So to those people, I want to say to you, study physics. we are not solid matter, y'all. It's time to wake up to the fact that, like, we seem to be solid. We are just a bunch of bouncing little molecules. You know, everything is vibration. There's no hard lines between anything. If I am activating, energizing, and anchoring something really loving, really positive, and uploading that through this collective web of atoms, I am helping everyone. I'm helping everyone. I'm uplifting the heaviness of the energies that are out there and seemingly prevalent, but I actually don't think they are. I think love is dominant. That's my hope anyway.
I love that. And it kind of makes me think of the difference between empathy and compassion that I think a lot of folks don't always fully understand how it impacts our nervous systems and our bodies, how empathy, while we need it and it's the precursor to compassion, it actually can have inflammatory effects on our body, and too much empathy can negatively impact our body and our minds.
Yes.
And so often compassion, being more action oriented, gives all of the people, all those sensitives, all those empaths, something you can do.
That's right.
Even if it's something that you can't actually physically touch or, as you said, stop the two wars, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And even for myself, like, I'm a hospice volunteer here at the Mayo Clinic. So I sit with terminal patients and I spend time with them. And it's like, what is that thing, especially for an empath? What is that way of being of service, of seeing that there's a direct measurable result in someone else's life? Sometimes we feel more depressed or more anxious when all of our attention is hyper-focused on ourselves. If I shift my attention onto another, like even if a friend calls you and they're having a really bad day or they had a fight with their loved one and they need your support, you know how to jump into the cheerleader role, the ally role, how to build them up and make them feel better. And sometimes after that phone call, you feel a little better too, because you could be of service and help someone that you love and make them feel better. And maybe you heard some intelligent things that you said that you should also be taking your own advice, right? So it's helping others also benefits you. And that's going to be, it doesn't matter if it's with humans, maybe you foster animals or volunteer at a shelter, you know, maybe you just give blood at blood drives, maybe you get involved with a charity, like looking outside of yourself and stepping into action with compassion can also be really fulfilling.
Devin, you've been so, so easy to understand and so descriptive about things that I think sometimes people get a little lost or overwhelmed about with meditation. And I wonder, do you feel like our Western society gives meditation the space, the credit, the accessibility for folks that is really necessary? And if not, what do you think could be done about that?
I mean, I guess I only have my 44 years to draw on, my 44 years of experience, but I'd say we're headed in the right direction. I mean, just the fact that there are so many apps out there, whether they're membership-based or they're free. There's so many free meditations on YouTube. There's, you know, even on Netflix, you'll see like Headspace has a little animation on there that you could watch. You know, it's like, I feel like people are more aware and more sort of accepting of meditation than they have been for a very long time. So this I find encouraging. I think that the science, thankfully, has come to a point where it is absolutely validated, and people can no longer deny it or say that it's too woo-woo or that it serves no purpose mentally, physically, and emotionally. So, I mean, I feel really thankful that we do live in a culture that seems to be waking up to the fact that just because we're doing things the way that they've been done for a couple hundred years doesn't mean that's the way that they should be. That normal, right. Normal isn't always healthy. And I think that people are starting to wake up to that and starting to question everything, whether it's work-life balance or realistic expectations, checking in with yourself and recognizing, who am I authentically? Like, if I could be anybody, if my only job is to be myself 100%, who would that be? You know, and how do I empower that person to come out and shine? So I feel great about it. I really do feel encouraged. If you're needing support, if you're needing meditation, it's just a click away.
You're very right. And, you know, one of the things that also comes with accessibility that I'm curious about is the commitment piece. I think a lot of folks get a little overwhelmed by the idea of having to commit hours on end, or even minutes for some people is tricky. I know some studies have shown that, I want to say 3 weeks in a row of 20 minutes helped increase gray matter in the cortex, which is incredible, especially when you consider things like ADHD or trauma or all the executive functions that happen up there. So ideally, I would love to put on my calendar 20 minutes a day for the next 3 weeks, but that's not always possible. No. So what would you say to listeners who loved everything you had to say, but are a little uncertain how they're going to make this work for their life going forward?
Great question. I'm glad you asked it. This might be unpopular. This might make me unpopular with other meditation teachers. But if someone is telling you that there's a minimum amount of time, to me, that's just BS. 2 minutes is 100% more than zero, right? And it's like, for me, it doesn't have to be 20 minutes or an hour. Some like Vipassana says it has to be an hour in the morning and an hour at night. I know the 20 minutes in the morning and night is really popular. And I'm not saying that there isn't a benefit to sitting longer. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying one push-up is better than none. 2 minutes of meditation is better than zero. I mean, if you did 10 minutes of meditation each day, that's 3,650 minutes in a year. Think about that. Like, So it's like, what time do I have? We all have 5 minutes instead of scrolling, you know, instead of maybe even when you're going to the bathroom. My guru used to say, if you can't find time to meditate, just excuse yourself and go to the bathroom, and no one will ever ask you why you were in there so long.
True.
That was great. But it's like, tie it to your routine. If I can sit for if I know I brush my teeth twice a day, maybe I sit and I close my eyes for 3 minutes and just enjoy that minty freshness and just, you know, watch my breath or visualize maybe the metta meditation, sending some blessings, some well wishes to people. That's great. 3 minutes. And then another 3 minutes at night, you're on the road to success, because from my perspective, consistency is far more important than quantity. And I'm going to tell you why. It has to do with what we talked about and touched on earlier. What you're doing in meditation is you're shifting your identification away from the person, from the body, from the realness of the experiences and the thoughts and the intensity of the emotions. You're shifting your attention back to the neutral witness, to the observer of the mind, of the body, of the breath, blah, 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 right? That observer is always present and always peaceful, always silent and always existing. It's like a huge relief to just be the observer. So familiarity is what we need to shift that identification. It can happen in a few seconds. So to me, 2 minutes is a win.
Oh, yeah.
If you can work it in wherever you can, it's going to work for you. It will. And as soon it won't be a discipline. It starts as a discipline. It becomes a craving.
I love that.
Yeah. And, you know, I also wanted to address, because you created a list of questions and a lot of them were so brilliant. I want to say too, especially for people who are, you know, neurodivergent of any kind, you do not have to sit still.
Oh, yeah, okay? Good point.
Remember the yeah. So there is such a thing as active meditation. Mm-hmm. What I'm referring to is classically passive meditation. I'm sitting still. Mm-hmm. I'm closing my eyes. It's beautiful because we've let go of all the distractions, mm-hmm. so we can really tune into the observer. But remember that definition of mindfulness is simply paying attention to the present moment without judgment. Mm. I can do that while I'm running, walking. I can do that while I'm swimming. I can do that while I'm eating.
Yeah.
I can be mindfully eating, mm-hmm. just really enjoying the colors, the textures, the smells, the company of the person I'm eating with. Just be really present, because the byproduct or the effect of being present is being easy and joyful.
Mm, I love that.
So bring that sense of mindfulness to whatever verb you're doing. And then every moment of your life becomes this rolling meditation.
That is so wonderful.
Yeah. You're welcome.
I mean, honestly.
Thanks for wanting to talk about my favorite topic.
I love it. I love it because I never stop learning from all of the wonderful people we get to talk to. And like I said, the way you described some of the things that can be so overwhelming to understand are just poetic. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. And I hope all of the listeners go feel inspired, give it a try, whether it be on the toilet or sitting in your favorite corner with a candle, wherever it may be. I hope you find that time and that place. Is there anywhere, speaking of places, that you would like to send our listeners to find you and what you have to offer?
I really suck at answering this question. So my home base, I'm not terrible at marketing. My home base is called withinmeditation.com. So it's where I started teaching after I got back from India in 2018. You can find my classes on there. They're virtual, they're live, but if you sign up, you also get the recording for a week. But I work with a lot of different companies that I would call them intermediary, like corporate wellness providers. Mm-hmm. So I'm a freelancer and I work for a lot of different companies. You can find a library of my free meditations and they're half an hour and they're free. So at storyhackers.com. Where else can you find me? At Club Pilates, if you're in Minnesota. You can find me on Instagram. I'm always just using my name. You can find me on Facebook that way. If anyone wants to reach out and continue a conversation, if you need tips, if you need resources, if you want a book list of recommended reading, please reach out to me. I'm such a nerd with meditation. Like it just excites me so much to hear from anyone. So yeah, that's a good way to find me.
Thank you so much. And I am going to jump on those 30-minute meditations soon because I cannot wait to check them out myself. Yay. Thank you so much, Devin. And we really appreciate the time and everything you shared. So goodbye and be well, everyone.
Have you wanted to learn about the importance of self-compassion for handling adversity and making positive changes in your life? Or how to use compassionate self-talk in establishing a growth mindset to cultivate courage when encountering challenges? In Dr. Amelia Kelly's Insight Timer course, Reducing Stress with Self-Compassion, Self-Care, and Resilience Strategies, she offers a series of writing exercises, meditations, visualization work, and introspective opportunities to practice self-compassion in real time. Find the course on Dr. Amelia Kelly's Insight Timer channel through the link in the episode notes below.